Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dad's dumb government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dad's dumb government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love him sometimes? Well, your dad's dumb government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dat dumb government? Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes?
Welcome to the Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike Gaddy. How you doing, Mike?
Doing well, Terry. Hope you are.
Well, I've just been running like a crazy person and watching all the insanity going on in the world around us. And I'll tell you, it's difficult to stay focused when you see such craziness going on and all of the planned chaos, the paid-for, bought protests and people getting shot and trying to take phasers away from cops. And it's just, you know, it's a loony world out there. And I think maybe we can bring a little bit of sanity back to things here, talking about the anti-federalist. And before we get started, I better open this thing with a prayer so we can get some divine intervention and prayer, because I think we might need it tonight.
Yes, sir.
Almighty Father, we're just we're grateful for this life, for the opportunity to learn, and wow, you've put us in a situation that you either grow or you die in, and I believe that you've put us here so that we can learn to make the right kinds of decisions, and I know that if we follow the example of your son, that's the best route we can take. And I know that he was very divisive because he insisted on truth, Father, and that's what we do here at Handling the Truth, is try to bring out the truth, and especially your truth. And we pray that everything we bring forward here is in your desire. And we just pray that you open the hearts and minds and ears of the listeners. Take control here, Father. We need your spirit to be involved in our efforts, because we know that we'll beat our heads against the wall without you, and our efforts will be multiplied if they're within your desire, within your blessing. Thank you for your son, Yahshua HaMashiach, and it's in his name we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, I know you've been wanting to take a dive into one of your favorite anti-federalists, Mr. Patrick Henry. And I'll just get out of the way and let you give us a lesson.
Well, thanks, Terry. I think, you know, there are many places to start with Patrick Henry. And, of course, you could start with his presentation to the House of Burgesses as the youngest member there in 1765, when he made his opposition to the Stamp Act and was called a traitor for doing so. And that was basically his beginning. But to me, the time when Patrick Henry really, if I could use the word, you could really see the very essence of the man, had to be during the Virginia Ratification Convention. And to me, that started on the very first day that he spoke, which was June the 4th of 1788. And so I would like to, first of all, just quote what he said. And I think that will lead us into something you and I have talked about, is being asked, what's the difference between a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist? And I think Patrick Henry displayed that so well on June the 4th. And his opening statement was, and I quote, "I consider myself as the servant of the people of this Commonwealth, as a sentinel over their rights, liberty, and happiness. I represent their feelings when I say that they are exceedingly uneasy at being brought from that state of full security which they enjoyed to the present delusive appearance of things." That, you know, in that one paragraph there, I think there is so much that shows us exactly the difference between a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist. Because here was Patrick Henry at the very beginning talking about considering himself as a sentinel or a guardian for the people's rights. And we don't find that in any writings that I have been able to find of the Federalists. Any of their letters, anything, they talked about the powers of government as opposed to the rights of the people. And to me, that's the critical part. And of course, you know, we all know, or we should know, that Patrick Henry had been invited to attend the Constitutional Convention of 1787, and he refused to do so, stating he smelt a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia. And boy, did he have that one nailed. So here again, you know, look at the words. He said he was the sentinel or the protector of the people's rights, liberty, and happiness. And contrast that with the Federalists saw themselves as the masters and controllers of the people and their property. And, you know, let's compare the words that we just read from Patrick Henry with the words of, let's go with George Washington. And that, I think, is critical. And, you know, we all think of Washington, and if you attack Washington today, you're going to be, you know, unless you want to accuse him of being a slave owner. If you say anything about George Washington today, you're going to make an awful lot of people angry. And back then, in 1788, the exact same thing was true. And I was doing some research, and I found Forrest MacDonald, who was considered to be one of the best authors of the founding era period. And I was really amazed of the fact that he looked at George Washington very objectively. And here is what he had to say. And again, this is Forrest MacDonald. He said, "Washington at 54 or at any other age could have added little to the intellectual average of any convention. And his knowledge of what to do in any convention barely extended beyond knowing the rules of order. But that was all Washington needed to know, for any assembly he attended was likely to elect him the presiding officer. He had two attributes that, even without his unparalleled prestige, prompted men to choose him, the leader. And it mattered not that one of the attributes was trivial and the other he carried to the point of triviality. Nor did it matter that for the last third of his life he was largely and self-consciously just playing a role. The first attribute was that he looked like a leader. In an age in which most Americans stood about 5 feet five and measured nearly three-fourths that around the waist, Washington stood 6 feet and had broad, powerful shoulders and slim hips, and he had learned the trick, when men said something beyond his ken, of looking at them in a way that made them feel irreverent or even stupid. The other attribute was his personal integrity. At times, Washington's integrity was bewildering, for his artlessness and his susceptibility to flattery led him to endorse actions that less scrupulous but more cagey men might shun. And at times, it could be overbearing, stifling, but it was unimpeachable." Pardon me. "And everyone knew it, and that above all made Washington useful. Others would do the brain work and the dirty work. Washington needed only to be present. But if there was to be a national government, Washington absolutely had to be there to lend his name to the proceedings. And that, I thought, was an accurate, objective viewpoint from a master historian. And he said it as it was. He didn't paint flowery pictures. He didn't put things up there. And he is one of the, pardon me, again, he is one of the few that did that. But I also found, and if I may contrast this at the time, he said that polar opposite to Washington in characteristics stood the theoretician James Madison, who was equally important to the nationalist cause or the Federalist cause. McDonald said of Madison, he at 37 or at any other age was Washington's opposite. Few men look less like a leader, scrawny and pale, a bookworm and a hypochondriac. He owned a physical no presence as uncommanding as one was likely to meet. But his knowledge of what to do in a convention was vast, and his talents for doing it matched his knowledge. At base, he was a brittle doctrinaire theorist. But these very attributes were useful. Practical, freewheeling politicians can always use a good theoretician, much as practical, freewheeling businessmen can use a good lawyer. And together with persistence, shrewdness, and devotion to the nation, they made him a priceless member of the nationalist group at the convention, or as they call themselves, the Federalists. So let's go. We heard Patrick Henry's words. Let's move over to Washington's words now, and I would like to use Washington's words in a letter to John Jay just a few days before the convention in 1787. And I quote, "Experience has taught us that men will not adopt and carry into execution measures the best calculated for their own good." I'm not sure who he meant in that, but he said, "without the intervention of a coercive power." In other words, he says, the majority of people are not going to do what we think is best for them unless we force them to do it. And then he said, "and Congress have too frequently made use of the suppliant, humble tone of requisition." In other words, they have asked instead of ordered. He said, in applications to the states, when they had a right to assume their imperial dignity and to command obedience. Is that not what every politician we have today, including the governors of these states, is this not the exact attitude of these people today? And this is what Washington said back then, that politicians have the right to assume their imperial dignity and to command obedience. And then let's look at the words of Gouverneur Morris at the convention in Philadelphia. I also think this is definitive wording from a Federalist. And he said, and I quote, "this country must be united. If persuasion does not unite it, the sword will." Now, compare the words of the Federalist, Gouverneur Morris and George Washington, with the words of Patrick Henry. Did either any of the Federalists ever say, look, we're coming here to create a government to protect the rights of the people? No, they never said it. So if you want to look at the difference between a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist, let's look at what Patrick Henry called himself, a servant, and look what Washington said they were, the master. So they're diametrically opposed to each other. So here's how we look at this, and we wonder how these things came about. Why did this one group of people end up writing a constitution and the masters that the servants of the people opposed? And again, I would like to take the words from Patrick Henry himself. And this is one thing that he did, and this is something I've always wondered about. And he made the statement, he said, "the act of assembly appointing deputies to meet at Annapolis," and he's talking about the Annapolis Convention that took place the year before, which led to the Constitutional Convention of 1787, he said, to consult with those from some other state on the situation of the commerce of the United States. The act of assembly appointing deputies to meet at Philadelphia to revise the Articles of Confederation and other public papers relative thereto should be read. So Patrick Henry at this point was trying to expose the Federalists for what they did and how they had, as Samuel Bryan, writing as Sentinel, called it a criminal conspiracy. And you can call it criminal. I don't know how you want to define that. But the one thing we do know is that these people were acting totally outside of the orders that had been given to them by Congress. And again, Terry, we're looking at a similar situation with a constitutional convention today, because Congress can tell these people to have a new constitutional convention, but they are by no precedent obliged to adhere to the rules that Congress might set for them, because without a doubt, Washington, Madison, and Gouverneur Morris certainly didn't. But I've written that the Federalists must have absolutely frozen in their shoes at this motion from Patrick Henry. Had all of these Federalist machinations to form a new government been made public at this time, the very idea of ratification would possibly have been completely obliterated. But immediately, the very passionate, repeatedly clashed with Patrick Henry over his stamp on the Stamp Act back in 1765, and other issues with England, he considered to be divisive. He did not like Patrick Henry at all, and he had previously referred to Patrick Henry as a demagogue. And he made a completely absurd yet very revealing objection to the motion I just read from Patrick Henry. And he said, and I quote, "Mr. Chairman, we are not to consider whether the Federal Convention exceeded their powers." What? We are not to consider whether they exceeded the powers that were given to them by Congress? And then he says something even better. He says, "It strikes my mind that this ought not to influence in any way our deliberation." So you're not to consider that the people that had written the Constitution had violated every rule they were given? You're not supposed to consider that in your deliberations? And then he goes on to say, "This Constitution was transmitted to Congress by that convention, by the Congress transmitted to our legislature, by them recommended to the people. The people have sent us hither to determine whether this government be a proper one or not. I did not expect these papers would have been brought forth." He's talking about all of the paperwork on how they went about criticizing the Articles of Confederation and accomplishing this new convention. "Although those gentlemen were only directed to consider the defects of the old system and not to devise a new one." So the very first day of the Virginia Ratification Convention, Edmund Pendleton admits they violated. And he said, "If they found it so thoroughly defective as to not to admit a revising and submitted a new system for our consideration, which the people have deputed us to investigate, I cannot find any degree of propriety in reading those papers." They did not want the papers read, Terry. They did not want the people to know how they had misused the trust of the sitting Congress to do this. So, and basically the Federalists, as voiced by Pendleton and himself, stated that it was irrelevant as to whether they had acted unconstitutionally in forming the new Constitution, and such crimes ought not to influence the convention in its decision-making process. Can you imagine any defense attorney making such a defense in a criminal trial? Well, it doesn't matter if they violated the law, and we shouldn't even use that in our deliberations about this crime. That's absolutely absurd. But how many people even know
that?
Well,
Mike,
yes, sir.
Let's camp here for a minute. what does this really say? What are we hearing here? What am I hearing? I want to kind of tell you what I'm hearing and
Please
get
do.
Your feedback on it. I'm hearing these comments are basically admissions of a sociopathic condition, if not psychopathic condition. These people recognized by their own words that what they were doing was in fact wrong, but they proceeded to do it anyway. That they're so narcissistic, they're like megalomaniacs who have puffed themselves up and worship self so much and care so little about the rights of others that they literally either have no conscience or ignore it. And what do we see on the other side of this coin with the anti-federalists? We see them saying, look, this is not, this isn't what I'm here. I'm not supposed to be doing this. And their conscience took them away. They went home because they could not continue to go against their own conscience. Am I getting the wrong picture here? I mean, I see a clear division between the morality of these people.
Well, I think said it perfectly. And last week we were talking about Luther Martin and his comments about Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. leaving and citing the reasons they left because they felt like that the people of the state of New York had not given them the power and that they were violating the trust that the people had given them. And they basically said that in their own letter to Governor Clinton. And so, yes, here I thought this was so significant, this first day of the Virginia Ratification Convention, that Edmund Pendleton would admit to the gathered people that, yes, they had violated the rules that they had been given, but that should not be used in the deliberations. We can't even decide that. And yes, I think you strike at the very heart of the matter of the two attitudes of the people. And it was definitely a sociopath at the minimum and a psychopath at the maximum of these people who believe that by some turn of fate they were more moral or whatever, and that other people should listen to them. And if the people didn't listen to them, as Washington said, we have the right to coerce you into doing it. So, yes, you struck right at the heart of it, Terry. And so here I would like to continue on with what Patrick Henry said on June the 4th. And I think this is very relevant. He said, Mr. Chairman, the public mind, as well as my own, is extremely uneasy at the proposed change of government. Give me leave to form one of the number of those who wish to be thoroughly acquainted with the reasons of this perilous and uneasy situation and why we are brought hither to decide on this great national question. Before the meeting of the late Federal Convention at Philadelphia, a general peace and a universal tranquility prevailed in this country. But since that period, they are exceedingly uneasy and disquieted. When I wished for an appointment to this convention, my mind was extremely agitated for the situation of public affairs. I conceived the republic to be in extreme danger. If our situation be thus uneasy, whence has arisen this fearful jeopardy? It arises from this fatal system. It arises from a proposal to change our government, a proposal that goes to the utter annihilation of the most solemn engagements of our states. I expected to hear the reasons for an event so unexpected to my mind and many others. Was our civil polity or public justice endangered or sapped? Was the real existence of the country threatened? Or was this preceded by a mournful progression of events? The proposal of altering our federal government is of a most alarming nature. And then he said, it will be necessary for this convention to have a faithful historical detail of the facts that preceded the session of the Federal Convention. Here is where Patrick Henry struck at the very root of the problem when he said, all right, we need the people are deserve to know why that you felt like you had to change this system. Why did it have to change? And I don't have them right available right now. I'll try to find them in a second, Terry. But I can show in a letter from George Washington where he talked about, prior to this, where he talked about how wonderful the country was doing after after the peace with England and how they were beginning to make a comeback. And he talked about how great it was. Robert Livingston did the same thing in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, talked about how great the country was doing. And then suddenly these Federalists say, oh, no, the country's not doing well at all, and we need to change everything.
And, well, that's exactly what we're facing today. That's exactly what we're facing today.
Looking straight at it, and history does repeat itself. And Patrick Henry then says, if these things were of such an awful magnitude as to warrant a proposal so extremely perilous as this, I must assert that this convention has an absolute right to a thorough discovery of every circumstance relative to this great event. And here I would make this inquiry of those worthy characters who composed a part of the late Federal Convention. I am sure they were fully impressed with the necessity of forming a great consolidated government instead of a confederation. That this is a consolidated government is demonstrably clear, and the danger of such a government is, to my mind, very striking. When you come up with a centrally consolidated government to where the people cannot say no, Terry, that's the very essence of socialism. And I know it makes people angry, but in my feelings, in my thoughts, this is exactly what happened. This was the beginning of a socialistic form of government. And to go even further, I will go with Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The very first power was unlimited taxation from unlimited sources. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1.
How did that differentiate from the Articles of Confederation?
Well, in the Articles of Confederation, the federal government made their appeals to the states for money based on population. In other words, if they had a debt, let's say just hypothetically $1 million, that the federal government needed $1 million, they would then go to each one of the states, and by population, they would say, here is what you owe, your proportion of what you owe, so it's up to you in the states how you collect this. The form of taxation is left up to you in your individual states. However you do it, that's your choice. But here is the amount we need from each state. So that was the difference in the way it was done, and there was no way that if a state said, well, you know what, we don't think this money is being used properly, so we're not going to pay it. And this is Patrick Henry put voice to this, and he said that taxation should always be against the states as opposed to the individuals, because they can't put a state in jail for not paying.
That broke up a little bit. Would you repeat that last sentence, please?
Well, Patrick Henry wanted the taxation to be on the states as opposed to the individuals, because he said if the states decline and say, I don't like how you're using my money, federal government, so we're not going to give you any, that the federal government could not put a state in jail, whereas if they're taxing individuals, they could say, okay, if you as an individual said, hey, I don't want to give my money to Planned Parenthood, so I'm not sending my taxes this month or this year. So if you as an individual, you say that, you will be put in jail, and if you resist, you'll be shot. Patrick Henry did not want that to happen, and the Anti-Federalists did not want direct taxation on the people. They wanted the taxation to remain as it was in the Articles of Confederation, so that the states could then say, okay, the states had a say-so. That's what the Federalists needed to do away with, was the say-so of the states. They needed to be able to tax the individuals and to compel them, and as Gouverneur Morris said, that we'll use a sword if we need to make sure that the people pay what we think they should pay. So that was the difference.
So they had to, I'm going to make an assumption here, and you can confirm or deny, but it seems like they forced to put a non-apportioned direct tax or prohibit, they were forced to prohibit a non-apportioned direct tax in order to get the Constitution ratified. How did they see their way to get past that in the future? Did they recognize that they would just be able to simply ignore it or use the courts to call it something else? Or, you know, they've had to bluff and fake their way around that, but it seems like that's not really what they wanted to put in there at the time.
Well, I think it's critical, Terry, that the very first power they gave to Congress, if you want to know what someone is after, they usually put that at the top of the list. So they wanted a new constitution that would give them unlimited taxation powers. That was the point of the Constitution. You can add all the other stuff that you want to. That was very profoundly the reason, in my opinion, for the Constitutional Convention. They tried to disguise it by saying it was for commerce. Oh, it's a commerce thing. It's a commerce thing. And that was deceptive. It was a tax thing. And what they wanted to do was to have the unlimited taxing authority that King George had. So and that is one thing that I would like for us to do at some point in time. I believe that one of our shows that I can draw a very close parallel between the American Revolution and the Civil War, that basically they ended up being fought under many of the same circumstances for the same goals. But that's for another time. But this, if again, and I hate to be redundant, but the first power given to Congress was the power of unlimited taxation from unlimited sources. There is absolutely no limit on the amount that the American public can be taxed. None. Zero limit. And that, to me, is absolutely unreal because, Terry, if you and I decide that we're going to go into business and we draw up a contract between us, and I say, okay, Terry, Article 1 of our contract says that at any time I can take all your money and I can take as much of it as I want and I can take it from any source I want. Is that a contract you're going to feel comfortable with?
It's one I'd run from.
Well, that's exactly what the American people did when they ratified this Constitution in 1787. They gave the federal government power to tax them at any amount from any source. And I challenge anyone to show me in the Constitution where it limits that in any form whatsoever, how it limits it. And my good friend out in California sent me the quote that I needed from Washington that I was looking for. And so, thanks, Neil. I appreciate it. But here is what Washington had said prior to suddenly deciding that we needed a new constitution because everything was terrible in the country. Washington had said, "Our internal state governments are daily acquiring strength. The laws have their fullest energy. Justice as well administered. Robbery, violence, or murder is not heard of from New Hampshire to Georgia. The people at large are more industrious than they were before the war. Houses are rebuilt, fields enclosed, stocks of cattle which were destroyed are replaced. The foundation of a great empire is laid, and Providence will not leave its goal imperfect. How did George Washington go from that to the point of saying that, hey, it's time for us to tax the people any way we want to, and if they don't agree to it, then we'll impose our imperial dignity and demand that they do it? Where was the bridge he crossed, the mental bridge, or where was the bridge that he crossed that made him decide that, hey, this is something we ought to do? That is the part, Terry, that is just astounding to me. And again, why would anyone want that to happen? Why would anyone want the central government to have unlimited taxing power? And we go back to the part of where every state, when they submitted their proposed amendments to the first Congress, every state put in their proposed amendments no direct taxation on the people. They tried to recover what was lost going from the Articles of Confederation to the new Constitution, but the committee that was appointed in the House of Representatives threw that out. It was never brought up. It was never discussed. And then Thomas Tudor Tucker, brother of St. George Tucker of South Carolina, he tried two or three times at the Constitution, at the first Congress, I'm sorry, at the first House of Representatives, at the first, he brought it up three times on the direct taxation. And all three times it was pushed backwards by none other than James Madison, the founder of the Constitution, or the father of the Constitution. So obviously the Federalists, and if you go through the letters, and there are 141 letters that I've been scouring and going through, and I've been trying to list some on the founding era studies group, is that they are absolutely, the Federalists keep talking about maintaining their powers and not giving up anything with these proposed amendments. They do not want those amendments to affect their power to tax the people in any way, and the first Congress proved it. And as I stated before, the first Congress in the House of Representatives, the Federalists outnumbered the Anti-Federalists 5-1, and in the Senate, they outnumbered the Anti-Federalists 10-1. So there was no chance. And if you go by Article 5 of the Constitution, Terry, when all of the states, all 11 states, submitted the same amendment to the Congress, and yet the Congress threw it out, how can you call that a representative government? If we went by Article 5 of the Constitution, that should have been submitted to the states for ratification. Thoughts?
Well, I previously asked you if there was ever a time when the Congress either or both of the houses were not dominated by the Federalists like that, and you mentioned the time period of Jefferson's presidency is possibly the only time, as I recall. It just seems that today, that ratio is at least as bad as it was then.
Well, definitely. I don't think that you could look, I think that'd make an interesting subject for discussion. Are there any anti-Federalists in our Congress at all today? Is there even one?
And well, it's hard to find anybody on either side of the aisle that's not a statist.
Well, and that is a Federalist. If we go by the people in 1787, I don't think there's an anti-Federalist in Congress. The last one who might have been even anywhere close was Ron Paul. And, of course, he was called Dr. No, and that is basically what every congressman should be to the federal government is, no, you're not getting by with this. But that's not how it happens. So we look at the Federalists, we look at the Anti-Federalists. You know, I would like for us to, before we get away from the Anti-Federalists at some point, I would really like to touch on Samuel Bryan, who wrote as Sentinel, and especially to get into his latter essays, to where he basically exposed the fact that several of these Federalists had actually been involved in embezzling millions of dollars from the federal government during the Revolutionary War, and he makes a pretty good case for it. Of course, our revisionist historians say, oh, well, there was nothing to it. But his case is pretty significant that he makes against Robert Morris and Gouverneur Morris, and what they did with the first U.S. bank, or the Bank of North America, that existed from 1781 to 1785, and basically how they went into fractional reserve banking with that, and ended up basically milking millions of dollars out of the banking system for their own into their own pockets. And Sentinel exposed that, and that may be one of the reasons today that if you go on the internet, it is extremely hard to find essays 17 through 24 or 18 through 24. It's almost impossible to find them. And there is a book now that has all of those essays in it, but it's a very small book, but it'll only cost you about $900 on Amazon. So they obviously don't want people reading these things, Terry. But then again, you know, if we keep talking about things like this, we'll probably have some people who want to say some wonderful, intelligent things like the two callers did last week. You still there, buddy?
Well, I certainly, I'm just glad we don't have callers like that on a regular basis, and there's nobody's got their hand up at the moment, so we don't have to worry about it.
Well, you know, I look at the arch Federalist too. I think we need to touch on who I consider to be the arch Federalist, and that was, without a doubt in my mind, was Alexander Hamilton. And it must have been terribly frustrating for Alexander Hamilton to sit at this Constitutional Convention and watch what was happening. And he did call the Constitution of 1787 a worthless fabric. And it must, as I said, it must have been just really tough for him, because for years he had been working to undermine the authority of the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. And yes, that was its official name. And he wanted very much so to institute a monarchy on American soil. Hamilton had begun his quest in 1782 when he pushed the New York Assembly to petition the sitting Congress for a convention of states to revise the Articles. Now look, he did this in 1782. The government had been in place for 1 year because it was ratified in 1781 by Maryland, which complied that all states must ratify it at the time. So in 1 year, Hamilton is pushing for a new form of government. And here he sits, you know, 5 years later, almost a full month into the convention of 1787, and there was no united effort among his co-conspirators or his federal fellow Federalists, easy for me to say, for the monarchy that Hamilton so very much desired. So finally, on June the 18th of 1787, Hamilton laid out his proposal to the convention for a monarchy. Now, how many of us are taught about this in school? That he actually made an appeal and spoke for, I think it was 4 to 5 hours, begging for a monarchy. And you know what? I'm sure that this bothered his fellow Federalists that he did this. Because James Madison, of all people, made the statement, and this is documented, that he was upset with Hamilton because Hamilton had let the cat out of the bag. Now, what else can that mean? But they had this plan from the beginning what they were going to do, and Hamilton became impatient with the fact that they weren't getting where he wanted it to be, and so he makes it this appeal for a monarchy, for a president elected for, you know, appointed basically for life. And then this president would appoint, you know, the governors of every state for life. And basically it was a, he asked for a monarchy. So up until that point on June the 18th, Hamilton had basically been kind of quiet. He had left the efforts in the hands of his fellow Federalist Madison and the others, Gouverneur Morris. And he must have been very frustrated as multiple plans of government were being discussed, but not one of which provided the monarchy, the complete monarchy that Hamilton wanted. In desperation, Hamilton rose and began to briefly detail the history of historical federal unions. But totally betraying the name he and his cohorts had assumed of Federalist, Hamilton quickly concluded that the Federalism was hopelessly weak and ineffective, and that before, let me see, and that therefore, and I quote, "We must establish a general and national government completely sovereign and annihilate the state distinctions and any state operations." He said this on June 18th. It's in the National Archives. Hamilton then pointed to the British monarchical government as the model for American framers to follow. He attacked the masses of people, which Patrick Henry said he felt like he represented. Hamilton attacked them as being turbulent and changing and filled with passion. Hamilton called upon the convention to give the minority, who are the rich and the well-born, a permanent share in any national power. Hamilton proclaimed that making the rich and well-born into a national ruling class would most assuredly give them a vested interest in government. And he says, and therefore they will forever maintain good government. And then he said that only the rich and the well-born would be able to check the imprudence of democracy. Only the British-style executive could provide the force of government Hamilton wanted. Madison's Virginia plan did not go far enough in increasing the power of the government, for it was said by Hamilton to be but pork still with a little change of the sauce. He didn't like the Constitution. It didn't go far enough. In detailing what was in effect an elective, powerful monarchy, Hamilton called for a national executive elected for life, and one, moreover, and I quote, who dares execute his powers. The executive to be elected remotely by the public, by electors chosen in the various states, which is basically the college. But Hamilton also proposed a Senate elected for life, also independently by the same electors who would elect the president. In Hamilton's preferred form of government, there were to be no restrictions whatsoever on the absolute power of the central government. Total socialism. He said the Congress was to have, and I quote, the unlimited power of passing all laws without exception. And the executive, or the king, or the governor, as he called him, the supreme governor, would be the executive to have absolute veto power over anything that the Congress did. And also an executive office in each state would be appointed by the president with absolute power to veto any and all state laws. And all militia officers were to be appointed by the national government, and states were to have absolutely zero input at all. Well, this kind of matches Madison, who said he didn't want the states to exist at all except where they might be subordinately useful. In addition to a Supreme Court, Congress was to appoint inferior courts in every state so as, and this is the quote from Hamilton, so as to make state governments unnecessary. Total socialism. The type of government that that Adolf Hitler pined for in Mein Kampf. A primary reason given by Hamilton for replacing the Confederation with a strong national government was the weakness of the war power. Under the Confederation, the military was weak, according to Hamilton, and it is evident they can raise no troops nor equip vessels before war is actually declared. And if you go back to the Anti-Federalists, the thing they feared almost more than anything was a standing army. Strange indeed for Hamilton, as this Confederation seemed so weak because this was the same army under the same Confederation that had just the full military force on the planet. And good old Patrick Henry brought that up. How can we call this, you know, how can we call ourselves weak when we have just defeated England? So Hamilton's presentation, several hours in length, stunned those who heard it, even his fellow conspirators. But to men like George Mason and Elbridge Gerry, this was the complete embodiment of all of their fears of this nationalist design. To his fellow Federalists, Hamilton's openness to their ultimate goals was a terrible indiscretion, a mighty embarrassment, the imprudent revelation of all their fantasies they knew could not be achieved, and as one historian would write, and I quote, "With good reason, therefore, Madison exclaimed that Hamilton was up to his old trick of letting the cat out of the bag." And this time, the cat was a particularly ugly specimen that seemed quite capable of breaking up the entire convention. To his fellow Federalists, Hamilton was about to destroy what they had been working so hard to achieve, relief from the power of the states to thwart their every socialist design and goal. Madison and James Wilson rushed to denounce Hamilton's plan, both of them acting very quickly to assure everyone that they were deeply devoted to preserving the rights and powers of the states. Funny that they said that then, when prior to that they had said they didn't want the states to have any power. It took Madison's covering or his revelation of their exact plan, it took that for them to suddenly say, oh, no, no, we want the states to be, they're absolutely necessary. It this, to me, reveals the duplicity of Madison again, for he had written to Edmund Randolph prior to this convention, as I stated before, states should exist only as they were subordinately useful to the central government. Pardon me. Hamilton, obviously seeing the shock on the faces of his fellow Federalists, quickly added that he did not exactly want to abolish the states altogether, only to make them mere administrative subdivisions of the national government. Isn't that what we have today?
Absolutely.
Only one person, a fellow monarchist named George Read from Delaware, who had voted against the Declaration of Independence on July the 2nd, 1776, the only signer of the Declaration to do so, openly praised Hamilton's idea. Like a true socialist, he went even a step further to urge the obliteration of even the states as administrative subdivisions and then representation by eventually new administrative districts. He wanted to abolish the states altogether. The Federalist disapproval, however, killed the Hamilton plan completely. Hamilton then quickly left the convention for New York, one of five times he left the convention for purposes unknown. And we do know that Hamilton would go back to New York on five occasions. I've got all the dates that he left. And we know that when he would get to New York or whatever location he went to the other times, that he would write back to Rufus King and to other to Gouverneur Morris and ask them questions and about things. And then he contacted them and said, plan, and I think we've discussed that before, Terry, where he said he had a plan that he wanted to be there before the convention was over, and then suddenly we end up with the necessary and proper clause, which was never debated on the floor in the committee of the whole. So somehow we ended up with a necessary and proper clause, as again, not to be redundant, but it wasn't debated at all. And so, again, he went along with his ideas, but then he gets back to the convention right before it's over. He gets there about the time Luther Martin leaves, and then suddenly he is appointed to the Committee of Style, and he's been gone repeatedly, and he's appointed to the Committee of Style to help write the final draft of the Constitution. For those of you who would like to verify any of the quotes or anything that I have used describing what Hamilton did at the convention, I would refer you to John Chester Miller's Alexander Hamilton and the Growth of the New Nation, and then also to tell you that that was originally published in 1959 as, I think, a much better title, and it was called Alexander Hamilton, A Portrait in a Paradox. So these are documented. I didn't come up with these things, by Googling or reading Wikipedia. These are actually from those books, and as a matter of fact, I have those books myself. So they are there, and if you want to find your best history, go back to any book that was written before 1950 in this country, before the revisionist historians really took it apart. Any comments on that, Terry?
No, not really. Not at the moment. We got about 30 minutes left, actually, a little less than that, about 25 probably minutes left to go. And I know you wanted to specifically get into answering the question, what is the difference between a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist? And I know you've been going all around that, but I'm just wondering if you could maybe give us your short answer, like in less than 25 minutes, short answer, on have you been asked that? And what was your response? Or what would it be today?
Well, it would be very simple for me, Terry, and I can make it very, very simple, and it would take less than 25 seconds. Federalists wanted government, and the Anti-Federalists wanted the people's rights protected. You know, if you go lowest common denominator, there it is. If you read the Anti-Federalists, they were always concerned about the rights of the people. If you read the Federalists, they were always concerned about how can we protect government. And basically, their idea was, how can we protect government from the people? And we today obviously have a Federalist government. I was almost the very first time I heard our present incumbent president make the statement that this would never be a socialist country, I almost lost my lunch. That has to be one of the most absurd statements that anyone could ever make, in my opinion. So I'm not sure whether that's the most concise answer. And I think, again, if you read the Anti-Federalists, and you will see that time after time after time, they were just, Anti-Federalists with, how are you going to protect our rights? How is this new government going to destroy our rights? How can we prevent that? And when you go to the Federalists, you've got James Madison making some promises in Federalist 45 that were just you look at them today, if you don't laugh, it's you know, the powers of the federal government would be few and defined, and the powers of the states would be so numerous that we can't even count all the powers of the states. And he said that in Federalist 45. How can anyone read that today and not laugh? So to me, Terry, that's the difference between Federalists wanted the strongest government they could possibly get. They wrote a basically what I call a blueprint in 1787. They sent it out with all of the loopholes that they could put in it, especially those by the eloquent Gouverneur Morris. And they sent it out with absolutely no restrictions. Patrick Henry asked repeatedly, how can the people stop this? Where are the people's powers? How can the people hold government in check? How can we hold government accountable? He spent 17 days in June of 1787 asking those questions. Where is the accountability? If the government doesn't do what you tell us it's going to do, how can the people react to that? Where are the people's powers? How can they deal with a government that does that? And he kept asking the question. And I think that's today the reason is that people like David Barton, the only thing they want to talk about Patrick Henry is the fact that he was a Christian. And, they don't tell anybody that he opposed the Constitution more than anyone else. And fought so hard against it at the Virginia Ratification Convention that on a couple of occasions they thought he and Edmund Pendleton or he and Edmund Randolph were actually going to be involved in duels, that it became so contested and so heated. And we aren't taught that. They don't teach us that in school. And can anyone remember when the teacher stood up before the class and said, well, you know, Patrick Henry, who said, give me liberty or give me death, absolutely detested our Constitution. I don't think anyone's ever heard that, but it's the truth.
Not even a hint of it. I would expect or suspect that many of these so-called teachers, and I call them that. I don't mean to disrespect teachers. I think teachers as a whole deserve a lot of respect. But they've been deceived. They've bought into what they've been taught just the same way that the people. It's like the person who cuts the end of a roast off before putting it in a pan, and when they're asked, why did you cut the end of the roast off? Well, it's because my grandmother always cut the end of the roast off. Well, why did your grandmother cut the end of the roast off? Well, it turns out that her pan was too small, and she had to cut the end of the roast off to make it fit in her pan. And that's really the education system today. They're just regurgitating the same lies that they were taught. So I believe that if we were to go and ask without them hearing the truth, I think if we went and asked many of those teachers that we've had, do you believe that Patrick Henry opposed the Constitution? They would probably say, well, of course not. Because they didn't know.
Well, what was that movie years ago where they talked about computers and they said garbage in, garbage out? If there is a better description of the people we are seeing today who are tearing down monuments and all of this other stuff, if we aren't dealing with a generation, several generations now, of people who are nothing but garbage in, garbage out, because they have no knowledge of history and they're making decisions that affect other people without any thoughts whatsoever.
And we've got a lot of politicians that I don't know if they want to know the truth. I think that's the big part of it. If they did, they would seek it. But there's a lot of them that are easily deceived. I'm not sure that they're all insincere or deliberate deceivers. I believe that they're just easily deceived. That's why fear plays so heavily on them.
Well, you know, Terry, this week, after that wonderful, after our wonderful Supreme Court and Mr. Gorsuch and these wonderful people came up with that wonderful LGBT decision, and Trump again, and I hate to even use his name, I don't like to use politicians pro or con, but when he said, well, the Supreme Court's ruled, we have to live with it, that is the most asinine statement I've ever heard him make. He obviously has no idea what the Constitution says. They are into a program of the government is in charge of everything and everybody will do what we say. And I don't believe there's anyone on either side of the aisle, Republican or Democrat, that doesn't believe that. They do not believe the people have any say-so in what they do. Their actions sure don't reveal it.
Well, you know my opinion on the banksters having, as long as they control the money supply, and even with Trump taking some control of the Federal Reserve, it hasn't slowed down their counterfeiting business. I mean, they've got so many different ways to create it at this point that they don't even have to print it. You just create it. It gets created on a ledger someplace. Did you see what happened? And it happened all the way back in March, and we never even heard about it when it happened. But the bank regulations on reserves have been dropped. Did you hear that?
Yes.
The banks no longer have a reserve requirement. Now you talk about
they can loan as much money as they want to.
You talk about bailing them out. Now banks can be bankrupt and still lend money.
Well, they've been doing
that for decades. That happened 3 months ago, and it's just now coming out, and it's only coming out because some of these really smart guys that watch really what's going on, that don't get their information from the mainstream news or even alternative, have disclosed this. I mean, we're talking the fiat currency that we're using today. There's an unlimited supply of it. It's an unlimited supply, and the people just haven't figured it out yet, which dilutes the purchasing power of it. It's just a matter of time until we need a wheelbarrow of it to buy a loaf of bread.
And that's coming.
And this is what they've done. So your bank no longer has to keep 8% of what they're lending in deposit. There is no reserve requirement. I hope people are listening.
Well, most of the people, Terry, I would be willing to bet, especially of people that I see on a day-to-day basis, if you told them exactly what you just said, that the banks now have no reserve requirement, they wouldn't have the foggiest idea what you just said. So
they need to wake up and realize it because it means if things come down, any money they got sitting in the bank is gone, and if they end up closing the doors on the bank, your safe deposit box will never be recovered.
Yeah, well, that's true, and that's the reason my grandpa hid his money in a can. He had gone through that Great Depression. Used to really make me laugh when I would hear an advertisement on TV or on the radio, make sure you bank down at you know, the First National blah, 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 because they're insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. You know, I never did take a lot of consolation out of the fact that my savings was insured by a government that owed $20 trillion. Sometimes you
you got some morons out there thinking that the solution is to form a state bank that's based on fiat currency.
Well, you know,
you
want to
look at what happened at the North Dakota Bank. You know, they had a really good state bank up there. And the governor appointed, I think it was a nephew or a second cousin or whatever it was nepotism. It was a nepotism appointment to put a relative of the governor, a couple of governors ago, put them in as the head of the state bank. And the idiot surrendered the regulatory authority for that state bank to the FDIC.
It's sad, Terry. It's sad to sit and look, but we have today the greatest illustration, and if someone writes about this point in history, this will be the results of a nation of the greatest concentration of morons in the history of man.
That doesn't leave a lot of solutions other than to turn to our Creator and recognize the value of our relationship with Him, and that it may be only Him that can protect us, and ultimately, of course, it is only Him that can sustain us. But I can't think of a time in my lifetime when it was more important to look to His truths, to His example on how we need to conduct ourselves going forward.
Terry,
I
could not be in any more agreement. And for years, you know, I don't know how many people I've had ask me as I've been teaching or trying to teach for the past 3 decades, how many people have said, well, what's your solution? You're telling us what's wrong. What's your solution? And I said, and I wrote an article, and it was called How You Fix This, But You Won't. Couldn't understand when you tried to tell them that things follow the laws of physics. You know, finances follow the laws of physics. Everything follows the laws of physics. And I said that if you want to change directions, the very first thing the law of physics will tell you if you want to change directions, is you have to come to a stop. You cannot change directions without at some point, regardless of the time involved, of coming to a complete stop. And I used to tell people, whatever you are doing, it's not working. Don't tell me that I need to vote. Don't tell me that, you know, this, that, or the other. I never heard anyone who won an election complain about the turnout. The only people who ever complained about the turnout were the people who lost. Didn't work. They still don't work. I mean, we've been electing people for how many years? Look at what has been elected. But the point of it is that you cannot, morons will not vote for bright people. Morons vote for other morons. It's intrinsic. It's what they do. Idiots vote for idiots. The uneducated vote for the uneducated. And I've said so many times before is that ignorance wouldn't be so bad if the people in America weren't so damn proud of it.
I don't believe we've gotten off topic. I believe that we've gone directly to the root of the topic.
Well, I think so too.
Somebody might be listening to our conversation and going, wow, they got off topic.
Well, that is possible.
I think that's exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at what the difference was between the anti-federalist and the federalist, and this points directly at that difference.
Well, Terry, and I agree totally. And here was the thing I have tried to tell people. People have asked me so many times, why do you care about studying all that stuff back then? And I said, because it is relevant today. You don't see different, you know, you may see a difference in levels, but you still see the same things. And when we look at what the anti-federalists said was going to happen, we adopted this form of government. It is absolutely astounding.
Well, I have to believe that they were listening to the Ruach, the spirit. I think they had a level of discernment that was divinely inspired.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a second.
Well, I think Red would be proud that we have focused this back in on the spiritual battle, because that's what was going on. You want to know the primary difference, I believe, between the anti-federalist and the federalist is that the anti-federalist had a conscience. They understood his truth. They were biblical. They were knowledgeable of scripture. I think they were men of honor, and they cared about people. And the federalists just cared about themselves and their own power and how they could make money and reward those that were behind them. They were paid just like the protesters of today. They're paid. They were paid. They had monetary gain for doing what they did. They were people who were calling in the favors and promising reward for personal gain. And that's what they were really basing what they did on, not about freedom, not about the people, not about inalienable rights. It was none of that.
Well, Terry, here's one of the things that I think we should do a show on sometime. And that is, let's draw the parallels between the people who made fantastic profits out of the Assumption Act. And let's parallel those people, and this goes to the point you just made, and let's go with the people who made fantastic, even millions, in 1789, 1790, 1791, the people who made millions on the Assumption Act, and how they were involved in getting the Constitution ratified. This had to be their payback. It had to be their payback moment, and that is not something I have seen dealt with anywhere by anyone in my studies, but the trail is, I think it would be neat to point that out.
I say we go for it next week. You game for next week?
Well, I am game. Yes, sir. That is something I just thought of that as you made your statement about the people who profited from this and they were paid. And I went immediately to the Assumption Act and how these people just really made just huge profits. It was said that Robert Morris made in the millions, that he may have seen a profit of $17 million from this in 1791-92.
You can multiply that amount by 25 to get a comparison today.
Right. And this was something, and who led the Assumption Act? It was Alexander Hamilton, and I think it is critical that Thomas Jefferson agreed to it to get the capital in the South. But Thomas Jefferson would later say it was one of the most terrible mistakes he ever made, was agreeing to the Assumption Act with Alexander Hamilton.
even the smartest man on the planet can make mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. But the character of the man is when he admits it, Terry. When he actually
I didn't buy it when Woodrow Wilson admitted to it.
Well, it may have been a pang of conscience. I think even these psychopaths. A psychopath has no conscience. I take that back.
Well, this has been a great lesson, and I appreciate you bringing all this information forward, Mike. As always, I became a student again tonight, and I thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, because I go back to my old adage, knowledge not shared is knowledge lost.
Well, let's wrap it up until next week. I think next week's going to be an exciting show. I think we need to draw a crowd.
Well, I look forward to that, and I would like to thank my good friends Jamie and Neil for tuning in tonight, and they kind of keep me on my toes with their text messages and send me some quotes and some other stuff, because they have read my stuff and they usually know where I'm going with what I'm saying. So thanks, guys. I appreciate you tuning in and everyone else who took the time to tune in tonight.
Absolutely. Well, we'll see you next week on Handling the Truth.
All right. Good night, Terry.
Well, you sold good night. No good sons of a shoe-fitting fire starters. Ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frames and nail it to your government walls. All of you. You dadgum government, you sorry rattle fratches. You got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dadgum, dadgum. Shoe-fitting fire starters. Ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry.